This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:08 p.m. on Thursday, May 4th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Johnston, myself, Representative Sponholz, Chair. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Take them all the way off vibrate if you can. Thank you. I want to thank Christy Blair from House Hess Secretary from Records and Cody Grusendorf from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Ted Madsen, who is our ABLE committee aide. Today we have three agenda items. The first is House Joint Resolution 20 by Representative Parrish. The second is House Bill 234 by Representative Guttenberg. Third is House Bill 236 by Representative Kawasaki. We're going to go ahead and get started with House Joint Resolution 20 on Medicaid expansion. Representative Parrish and Ms. Wuerl, if you can please come forward, put yourself on the record, and present the resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I am Justin Parrish. I'm the representative for House District 34. The resolution we have before us today urges the United States Congress and our President to maintain the Medicaid expansion to cover individual health insurance coverage. As I've mentioned to some of you, just yesterday I was diagnosed with walking pneumonia, and thank heavens I've got health care coverage, because otherwise I would have probably grimly soldiered on for another month, letting it sap my productivity and well-being. However, because I have health care, like the 31,000 Alaskans who were newly covered by Medicaid expansion in Alaska, I was able to go in and receive antibiotics, and with a lot of rest, I'll shortly be on the mend. Medicaid expansion also benefits the state of Alaska economically. As of March 31st, 2017, Alaska has received $413 million in total payments made under the expanded programs, which reduces the number of uninsured people visiting emergency rooms and provides necessary funding for behavioral health treatment and treatment for substance abuse. Now, Alaska has the second highest rate of residents without health care in the nation. I don't mind being the biggest state. I don't mind being the most rich in mineral resources, the most coastline, the most salmon. But gosh darn if having the second highest percentage of unemployed residents isn't something that wrinkles a bit.
But uninsured. Residence.
Uninsured. Thank you. However, because I'm not an expert on this, I will happily turn things over to Tom Chart from the Alaska Behavioral Health Association and Valerie Davidson, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Ms. Wuerl, was there anything you would like to add?
No, I thank you. For the record, Lisa Wuerl, the staff to Representative Parrish. No, I believe that Representative Parrish has covered.
Are there any questions for Representative Parrish before we, Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Representative. Thank you for being before this committee today. Just a couple questions, if you don't mind. As you've discussed here, Alaska has received $413 million in total payments under the expanded Medicaid program, and with that, that's the money that we have received from the federal Medicaid dollars. So what has the state then paid to match that? Is there a percentage then that the state pays? And if so, how much would that be?
Ms. Warren.
Through the chair, the state match is 5%. And I believe Commissioner Davidson can go into greater detail, but I do know also from their same records and reports that I've looked at, also there are the Alaska Native population that is served by the IHS also has additional coverage. So for those people, we actually get 100% coverage from the federal funds.
So in layman's terms, for every dollar we put in, we receive 19 federal dollars as match.
95%.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Proceed.
Thank you. And then, of course, in light of what's happened on the national side, you know, they just passed a portion of a change in the Affordable Health Care Act. Have you had a chance to look to see what those changes are and how they may affect Alaska?
I've had a thank you for the question and through the chair. I've had minimal time to look it over. Unfortunately, it looks like we may be moving towards a more per capita allocation of funds, which wouldn't be good for Alaska, considering our disproportionate healthcare costs and some of the other systemic challenges that we endure as a state.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, per capita, what do you mean by that?
Means that each state might be allotted a certain portion of funds in proportion to its population rather than the actual economic and health need of the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I think we may also be able to hear a little bit more from the commissioner on that. I believe I want to recognize that Representative Eastman and Representative Keto have joined us, and Representative Johnson had a question.
Yeah, I have a couple, and it's just in your whereases. You have on page 2, line 11, that the state spends the second lowest percentage of state funds on Medicaid. Where, because when I look for Medicaid and how we line up with the states, we're actually one of the highest. So I was just, I need to find where you're getting that from.
And I believe that Ms. Worrell has the reference.
I actually am going to defer this question to the department.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. To the chair.
And then,
thank you.
And this is for both you and the department. As far as the Medicaid expansion has reduced uncompensated care, and mm-hmm. one of the things that we have learned is the policy was if we had Medicaid expansion, then we would hopefully get the expensive emergency room care. We would decrease that, and it would be more preventative care. And what's happened nationally and has happened here in the state is emergency room care has gone up, which is now a given. And so, the policy isn't matching the outcomes. But the other part that we found out in this committee, which was actually also shocking, it's not just the emergency room care, but it's the emergency transport has gone up. And so I just, in that whereas, it's just something that I would have concerns about.
And that was, let's
see,
I added a moment
ago.
That's
on line 13, page 2.
Page 2 on line 13. This clause here, whereas Medicaid expansion has reduced uncompensated care provided by Alaska hospitals by tens of millions of dollars, which helps to reduce the cost to all patients, doesn't directly address the phenomenon you referred to, where there is overall higher use of emergency facilities, whereas previously perhaps they would have just stayed at home and duct taped over the injury, as my dear father has too often. This means that more people, 31,000 more people, if, heaven forbid, they should need to go to the emergency room, will have some sort of funding attached to them instead of just being written off as, lost bets, people who wouldn't be able to pay or for whom paying would represent a bank-breaking hardship, I believe. The majority of bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical debt.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for the sponsor before we ask Commissioner Davidson to approach? All right.
Actually, yes. With your permission, Madam Chair, perhaps we could have Mr. Chard come forward next.
All right.
I always say save your best for last. I think that's what we did there. For the record, my name is Tom Chard. I'm the director of the Alaska Behavioral Health Association. The Behavioral Health Association are a group of leaders from the mental health and drug and alcohol treatment centers all across the state, so we've got about 60 of them at this point. They're for-profits and not-for-profits. They are tribal and non-tribal. They serve our kids and our seniors and everyone in between, and they do phenomenal work. I just came from a meeting up in Anchorage where all of the substance use counselors had gathered to learn the best techniques to try to deal with our opioid crisis and to try to tackle some of the alcohol problems that we have in our state. So really honored to work with such a great group of folks. Thank you for inviting me to speak today on this resolution. You know, I was watching this morning, as I'm sure others were as well, to see what the outcome of the vote was going to be back in D.C. I thought I'd spend a little bit of time this morning talking about kind of the way things were, the best what I know right now, and then what may come. Before September 2015, before Medicaid expansion in Alaska, if an individual, in order to qualify for Medicaid, an individual had to fall into a couple of different categories. One, they had to have a child or a dependent that would be a qualifying characteristic. Two, they would have to be deemed disabled. And they were deemed disabled oftentimes by the Social Security Administration. And that's the one for me that I'd like to focus on for a second. For folks with mental illness, what this meant was they had to have kind of like the paperwork to figure out, to present to the Social Security Administration and go through their process to be deemed disabled to get onto Medicaid. For folks with substance abuse disorders, the chronic inebriates, the folks dealing with alcohol and drugs, the Social Security Administration, by and large, did not consider that a qualifying disability. So what that meant was it doesn't matter how poor you were, it doesn't matter how disabled you were because of your addiction, you likely were not getting Medicaid benefits as by that definition as being deemed disabled. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of folks walking around that had problems with drugs and alcohol that couldn't access care. We had a grant system mm-hmm. that tries to put a patch on that. And we spend a considerable amount of unrestricted general funds to try to meet that need. But frankly, we're falling short. And I think that, you know, we've kind of hit that critical point where our prisons are overcrowded, our emergency departments are flooded, and you guys are hearing this, I think, probably on a daily basis at this point, how the effects of untreated behavioral health disorders, be it mental illness or substance abuse, is really pressing our system. September 2015 comes around, we have Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion, for the first time, gives some resources to these individuals to be able to access treatment, to be able to access care. Our system is gearing up to be able to provide that access to treatment that's so needed, but frankly, that's a heavy lift on our side. We're doing as, you know, much as we can, as fast as we can, but it definitely is a heavy lift on our side. To transition a system that was financed by grants and prepaid to a system that is reimbursed by Medicaid dollars, to transition your clinical teams, your billing departments, and everything else, it's a heavy lift. But we're doing it, and one of the major reasons that we're very supportive of Medicaid expansion is because for the first time ever, these folks that needed treatment all along can walk through our front doors and get the access to the treatment that they need. Mm-hmm. It's keeping families together. It's keeping people out of public safety and criminal justice. If we can intervene earlier in these situations before the person is homeless or in jail or at API or in the emergency room or before the kid is taken away from the home, I mean, that's why we're in the work that we're in, the line that we're in. What happened this morning with the House's vote on the American Health Care Act, and I had an article in ADN last week talking about this a little bit. We're facing this opioid crisis. We're trying to work on some of the pandemic problems that we've had in the state with alcohol and drugs and some of the untreated mental illness. And the thing I think that I wanted to emphasize more than anything today was that there is a very high degree of uncertainty hanging out there right now. The uncertainty is with the individual that for years didn't have access to treatment, all of a sudden did have access to treatment, and now doesn't know if they'll be able to get that access in the future. The uncertainty lies with the providers who are in the midst of transitioning their systems over to a completely different system to be able to serve the people that need treatment, and we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So the article that I put in the ADN last week and my communications with our congressional delegation have been around maintaining certain aspects of the Affordable Care Act that we know that are working. There are things in the Affordable Care Act that are not working. I'll be the first one to tell you that. And I really applauded Senator Murkowski's comments that, you know, she said, we know there's things that are working, we know there's things that aren't. Let's fix the things that aren't and keep the things that are. And I couldn't agree more. So I guess one of the reasons that I appreciate this resolution is because Medicaid expansion is working. It's one of those things that is working phenomenally well, particularly here in Alaska. If you look at assessments of the American Health Care Act and what's out there, it doesn't do so well by our state. And then, you know, trickle that down, maybe that challenges our providers to deliver the care, and trickle that even further down, and what effect will that have on the person that needs that care. So, you know, the Behavioral Health Association is supportive of Medicaid expansion. We hope that when the pieces fall wherever they will, people can get the treatment that they need, and definitely always appreciate the support that we've had with legislators and understanding this problem and trying to help out.
Representative Johnson.
Two questions. One, you're bringing up Social Security and as far as disability, and once you get a Social Security disability, you can't go back to work, right? Or can you?
There's a program. I'm like so far out on a branch right now, yeah. But I'm going to go ahead and try my best to answer this through the chair. There's a program called SOAR that does actually stand for something, and it attempts to try to get folks the benefits counseling that they need so that they can go back to work and that they can engage. We know the therapeutic benefits of that, and we're always interested in supported employment and employment opportunities for the folks that we serve.
Follow up. So there are a number of states that actually did Medicaid expansion before Alaska did. And have you looked at the outcomes there as far as behavioral health and where they're at? Because some of them will have a couple years on us. And I have to say our behavioral health and our homelessness problem is a national. It's expanded greatly throughout. And, you know, is there any state that's doing it well?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, thank you for the question. I think that the department has done an amazing amount of work on trying to reform our behavioral health system to meet some of the gaps that we have, and has been working with the providers and with others to try to address some of these things. We know that our system has gaps. The Medicaid expansion was one of those things it's like this huge support that's coming in. Mm-hmm. As far as other states go, It's an interesting question because, yeah, so there's some states that are ahead of us in the game with Medicaid expansion, and I have been looking at some of what's happening there, but kind of overriding that is some of the reforms that are happening with behavioral health. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, the state was looking at how Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, and the state of Virginia, how they manage their systems of care. I know that groups have brought up folks from Washington and Oregon, and we've done kind of deep dives in different states to try to figure out what are they doing that we can beg, borrow, and steal up here to help improve our service delivery system. And that's something that I expect will go on regardless of the Medicaid expansion conversation.
And follow up. And in that review, are you looking at states that have Medicaid expansion and states that haven't had Medicaid expansion but looking for best practices?
Absolutely. Through the chair, absolutely. So I mentioned that we're the Behavioral Health Association for Alaska. As you might imagine, there are other behavioral health associations in other states. And so I confer with my colleagues often. And in those conversations, it's always a room full of people, and always some of the people that are like the Medicaid expansion states, and some of the people that aren't, and some of the people that are new or whatever. And it's always, what can we do with the resources that we have available to us? And I have to say, sitting on the side of the room that has Medicaid expansion, we just have more resources available to us to try to meet this need. Mm-hmm. And if I may, Representative Sullivan Leonard asked a question earlier that I think around the vote this morning and how that might impact mm-hmm. the state. I know the commissioner is way better prepared to answer this than I am, but from the mental health and substance abuse side, I did want to point out that there's a couple of things, the essential health benefits that were included in the Affordable Care Act mm-hmm. specifically called out mental health and substance abuse treatment and referred back to parity legislation that had passed before. Essentially, what the essential health benefits do is it makes sure that the plans that we have available provide access to mental health and substance abuse treatment services. I understand with the MacArthur Amendment that states, you know, who knows what it'll end up looking like, but currently, that states would have the option to waive out of the essential health benefits or define them how they would. I would just implore all those in that decision-making ability to really consider the impact on mental health, access to mental health and substance abuse treatment services, and what that essential health benefit does for our state and for the folks in the state. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is there additional questions for Mr. Char?
Thanks,
so I have a question for you while I got you. You know, one of the things that in my with my previous employer before coming to the legislature, I worked for the Salvation Army, where we provided you know, addiction treatment, and one of the challenges that that we had with the grant-based system was that if we had more patients or more people come to us that necessarily needed addiction treatment, we couldn't necessarily expand to meet that. Whereas with Medicaid, and you're talking about billing for, you know, each clientele, you could sort of expand to meet the need. Do you have any sort of a sense of what backing up away from Medicaid expansion might mean to some of the people that need those services, addiction treatment or serious mental health services might mean to the state of Alaska?
That's an excellent question, and thank you for that question. So one of the things that has happened since September 2015, so we have a grant-based treatment system predominantly for substance abuse treatment services, and we realized early on that if we can pull down a significant federal resource, you know, 90%+ FMAP from the feds mm-hmm. to pay for the same services, let's do that, and let's try to help the state with the budget problems that we're having by reducing our UGF for the grant line commensurate with our increase in our Medicaid expenditure for mm-hmm. behavioral health. And that system works, except if all of a sudden Medicaid expansion vanishes, you're going to be relying on the grant-based system, which we've been reducing over the past couple of years because we have this new resource. Mm-hmm. So the reductions that we've been taking to the grant line, you know, right now there's a $3 million reduction, just as an example, mm-hmm. This year. Those reductions are making that grant resource much smaller. Initially, we could take anybody that came through we could take a lot of people that came through the front door with the grant-based resources, but over time, those resources have whittled down to the point where we had to identify priority populations. I talked with you a month ago or so about that. Mm-hmm. And then they've even whittled down to a degree where some of our providers had to limit their referral sources. So if you were being referred from DOC or API, or, you know, somebody like OCS, then you would get a priority kind of placement. But, you know, as far as I'm a mild to moderate disorder coming in off the street, unfortunately, Representative Sponholz, your experience is correct. I mean, there's only so many resources to pay for the staff.
So essentially, with the if Medicaid expansion were to contract again, then our UGF contribution for addiction treatment would have to go, and other behavioral services, health services would have to go back up?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. And I think I understand what they're trying to do by driving down premium costs, mm-hmm. but without that rebalancing of resources, what's going to happen is they might drive down the premium costs by, you know, pulling out the high risk pool and, you know, putting extra money into the system like they're trying to do. But if you don't rebalance for your behavioral health resources, it's going to show up more increased pressure in the emergency departments and the prisons and other places that you spend your UGF on.
Yeah. Is there any other questions for Mr. Chern? All right, thank you very much. And I'd like to recognize that Representative Tarr has joined us. Commissioner Davidson? Make yourself comfortable.
Thank you. I'm out of practice. For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and here with me today is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner. House Joint Resolution 20 encourages the continuation of the Medicaid expansion program. And let me provide a few details, a few more details about Medicaid expansion and our experience in Alaska. We actually have new numbers through the end of April, and so those should be uploaded to our website here shortly. We do that shortly after the close of a prior month. We try to do that within 10 days. Since September 1st of 2015, when Governor Walker expanded Medicaid coverage in Alaska, 32,958 Alaskans have been covered under Medicaid expansion, representing about 4.48% of our state's population. About $445 million in claims have been paid for services in the following areas during that time period. So again, since go live September 1st, 2015. $126.4 million in inpatient hospital services, and basically these are folks who are sick enough that they had to be admitted to the hospital to be able to get back on their feet. It also included $81.4 million in outpatient hospital services. It included $109.7 million in professional services and clinic services. Those often include specialists, for example. $30 million in behavioral health services, and those include mental health and substance use disorder treatment services. And as we mentioned before, I think a couple of folks mentioned before, we really see that behavioral health coverage as really critical to our criminal justice reform efforts and our ability to be able to really make a significant impact in our state and our, quite frankly, in our Medicaid reform efforts. And I'll come back to that in just a minute. That $445 million in claims paid since September 1st, 2015, also includes $45.6 million in prescriptions, including life-saving medications for high blood pressure, diabetes control, etc., and $20 million in medically necessary travel, which ensures that Alaskans who don't have access to a specialist in their community can be cared for in the next closest community. In terms of the match rate for Medicaid expansion, the way that the federal law was set up was that states who expanded starting in January 1st of 2014 enjoyed three full calendar years at 100% federal match. Those weren't rolling years. I really wish they were, but they were hard calendar years. So if you, if a state signed up early, you got 3 years. Assuming that you continued, you got 3 years at 100% federal match. Starting in calendar year through 2016, starting in calendar year 2017, that match, federal match, is 95%, so 95% federal, 5% state. In 2018, it's 94%. In 2019, it's 93%. In 2020, that match transitions to 90% federal, 10% state match. So for the calendar year 2017, we are in a 95% match year, but our effective match rate currently is about 3.26%, simply because IHS beneficiaries who are Alaska Natives or American Indians like me, who are also Medicaid beneficiaries who receive their services through an IHS facility, and I quote that for a specific reason, the federal government actually reimburses the state at 100% federal match. The committee may recall that Governor Walker negotiated an agreement with then Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell to change the tribal claiming policy that allowed states to be able to extend that within through the IHS facility to also cover 100% for travel and also cover 100% for services that began in an IHS facility but were referred to a non-tribal facility in order to be able to extend that level of care. In this fiscal year, in our current fiscal year, that savings amounts to about $32 million in general fund savings for our state. And it will increase a little bit every year.
Representative Solomon Leonard has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Commissioner. Just a quick question. As you're talking, I'm thinking about the Medicaid rewrite from last year. Was that Senate Bill 74? And some of the pieces of it that I had heard was that there would be an overall savings of about $400 million. And as you're discussing the ratio between, you know, the federal dollars that are coming in versus the state, it sounds like as the years are going to be coming upon us, we're going to be seeing a decrease in federal funding, but an increase in state funding to cover cost or what have you. So can you kind of go over that a little bit?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, yes, I can. So if you don't mind, I wanted to be able to first stick with expansion and then tie it to those reform efforts, if I may, if that's agreeable to the committee.
Okay. Yeah, and actually, if we can hold questions until we get through it a little bit, or is it sort of urgent to the point? Can you hold it? Thanks.
Hope I remember it.
Write it down.
Yes.
I wanted to say, yes, ma'am. the other thing that Medicaid expansion has really done for Alaska is it has really infused a significant amount of cash into Alaska's economy. $445 million of cash into our Alaska economy, most of it federal, has really been a significant, has had a significant economic impact. The thing that I really appreciate about Medicaid expansion is that some economic development projects, while they're wonderful, really the benefit goes to Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and eventually may trickle to other communities. But the thing about Medicaid expansion is that that benefit actually goes to every community in which health care is provided, where there is a Medicaid expansion beneficiary. So if you're in a small community of 300 people and you receive your health care from a community health aide or a behavioral health aide or perhaps a dental health aide who travels to that community, then that community gets that economic benefit as well. We certainly have seen And of course, as we know from our Medicaid expansion numbers and where those claims have been paid, the biggest beneficiary in terms of economic boost has been to Anchorage and to the Valley. We publish our Medicaid dashboard every month on our website, which can be found at dhss.alaska.gov. If you go to our website and scroll down a little bit, you will see a dashboard that looks like this. And it shows not only the number of expansion covered Alaskans, but also provides some demographics in which age category and also whether they are men or women. We can also see the number of claims that have been paid to date. We also provide more information since Medicaid is often what I would call an exciting hot topic, making sure that we are very transparent and providing as much information to the public as possible. We include information on this dashboard also of our Medicaid program as a whole. One of the things that we have known now transitioning to Medicaid reform as well as criminal justice reform, this administration has said from the very beginning that we really see Medicaid expansion and reform going hand in hand. And that is certainly what we heard from providers as Senate Bill 74, last session's Senate Bill 74 was moving its way through the process. What we heard from providers repeatedly was the additional resources that Medicaid expansion brought to the table, again, primarily federal resources, really provided a little bit of cushion for providers to be able to do things a little bit more creatively. Some of the things that we have been working on was mentioned by Mr. Chard earlier. We've recognized for some time, we've certainly provided testimony in this committee that we right now have some pretty significant gaps in our behavioral health system. We have one person told me that I was perhaps a little too honest about that assessment, but I think that if you don't recognize the challenge that you have, you really never are able to move past it. And so over the last year, we have been engaged with providers and stakeholders to develop a new way of providing behavioral health services in Alaska. We want more flexibility because, quite frankly, some of the rules under the Social Security Act under which Medicaid is authorized don't provide us sometimes the flexibility that we need. And so we are negotiating what's called an 1115 waiver with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that will provide us that flexibility. The other thing that it does is Alaska has really been challenged probably more than any other state by a rule called the IMD exclusion, the Institutions for Mental Disease exclusion. And that rule says that if you have a facility that has more than 16 treatment beds, you cannot bill for Medicaid. That's not an Alaska rule, that's a federal rule, and it has been in place for some time. At the time, it made sense because folks who were experiencing chronic mental illness were really institutionalized and really were not treated humanely in our country. And as there was a significant effort to get folks to be really served in a most home-like setting and a least restrictive setting. Unfortunately, what that meant for treatment services, certainly for substance use disorder treatments, including all substances, including alcohol, that meant that facilities in Alaska, as you know, economies of scale, sometimes if you build a larger facility in a hub community, you may be able to get more bang for your buck, etc. That's a long version of saying that we have a CMS, our Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, our federal counterparts have indicated to states that they will be willing to amend existing 1115 behavioral health waivers to be able to waive that IMD exclusion, which will be huge for Alaska. We know that's going to make a significant difference for us. The other kinds of reforms that were included in Senate Bill 74, the biggest one is really the bill provided broad broad authority to the Department of Health and Social Services to really look at new reform opportunities that were being made available by the federal government, or being able to move quickly so that if there were new opportunities to be able to pursue, that we would be able to move forward to make those opportunities available for Alaska. Other kinds of things, specifics though, included a provision to address the overutilization of Medicaid beneficiaries or Alaskans utilizing the emergency department. So it built upon a couple of one program that is already existing in our Medicaid program. We had a program that was a voluntary program for Medicaid beneficiaries, or if somebody was would you be willing to be my example?
Sure.
Thank you. So let's say that John is a Medicaid beneficiary, and he has been to the emergency room really over. We call them super utilizers, but they're really over utilizers of the emergency department. If John has been to the emergency department too many times in a year, then we would reach out to the Medicaid program, would reach out to John and say, "Hey, John, I noticed that you've been to the emergency department a number of times. It sounds like you really could benefit from hooking up with a primary care provider. We've lined one up for you. We've set up an appointment for Tuesday. It's Friday. Would you be willing to do that?" And we thought at first that we would have a lot of resistance from beneficiaries, and we found that they actually really love it, because for some of them, for the first time in their lives, somebody cares about their health and cares about their outcome. And so John, I'm sure, would be gracious and say yes, he would love to have this kind of attention. And then we would call him again on Monday and say, "Hey, John, I want to remind you that you have an appointment tomorrow. Do you still have a ride lined up? Do you need some help getting there? Does Tuesday still work for you?" So that has been really a voluntary program. We also have another program for folks who experience acute conditions that is really a mandatory program. And I'm not, in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into those details. But for the super utilizer program that Medicaid manages, we increase the contract that we have with our care coordinators to be able to provide more service to Alaskans. There is another program, however, that is being pursued by ASHNA, with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, that is a public-private partnership, and looking at a similar program, but working with emergency departments of hospitals to ensure that folks know where folks are going, so that if John... you're such a good sport. If John has been to, let's say John went to Providence on Tuesday, and then he went to Alaska Regional on Wednesday, and guess what, on Thursday he went to the Alaska Native Medical Center, and then on Friday went out to the Valley, they're going to be able to have that information to be able to ensure that we can have better outcomes for John. And there are a whole host of other things. We actually just closed the RFP, request for proposals for a coordinated care demonstration project, that we are looking at any provider who is, or group of providers or companies or interested parties who are interested in doing better care coordination services for Medicaid beneficiaries in Alaska. We got a number of proposals, and so we are now in the process of doing the initial review of what those look like, and there is a care coordination committee, project review committee, which includes members of the legislature and members of the public who will be scoring those proposals and getting those programs up and running. So we're really excited about that opportunity as well. With regard to last session's version of Senate Bill 91, criminal justice reform, we recognize that we have the opportunity to build more prisons or build healthier Alaskans. And Alaska made the decision during the last legislative cycle session to build healthier Alaskans. And we know that we have the opportunity to get folks treatment if we intervene early. And also when folks are released back into the community, we know from the experience of other states that they have much better outcomes in terms of reducing recidivism if they have access to health care services upon release. And so Medicaid expansion is a critical component of criminal justice reform as well. Would you like me to comment about Affordable Care Act, or should we stop there and take questions? Or
I think we have a few questions now. I think Representative Johnson's been waiting for a while. I have two questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. One is back to the uncompensated care for the hospitals and that and the whereases. And I was looking at your backup documentation, and you have it to 2015. So it was $94.5 million. Then it was 2014, it was $89 million. And in 2015, it was $72.6 million. And this was before Medicaid expansion. Do we know why the uncompensated care was dropping those years? Since this was your backup documentation?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, this is actually information that was provided by the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. So
I was curious because it was before we did Medicaid expansion. It was showing a decrease. And it would be interesting. I'm sure you'll have more up-to-date numbers for
Perhaps Representative Johnston, given that is ASHNA's information, I was actually thinking that we might need to have ASHNA be available for questions at our next committee meeting so we could get an appropriate answer from the appropriate source.
Thank you. And a follow-up, and this is something that I've been confused about for quite some time, and I kept meaning to ask you on a sidebar. But so you have IHS, and it's always been my impression that IHS is fully responsible for the health care of individuals that qualify. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, the Indian Health Service covers IHS beneficiaries, people who are Alaska Native or American Indian, people like me, but under federal law, IHS facilities, which includes tribally operated facilities that we have in Alaska, are required to pursue third-party reimbursement from private insurance, from Medicaid, from Medicare, from any other source. IHS is actually considered the payer of last resort under federal law. The reason for that is because I think the latest, I haven't worked in tribal health for a 2.5 years, I think 3 years by now, but I did work in the tribal health system for 15 or 16 years. Yeah. When I left, the tribal health organizations in Alaska were actually funded at about 50% of their level of need based upon the federal government's own assessment of the funding needed. And I think in recognition of that, Congress mandated that they also seek third-party reimbursement, including from Medicaid.
Okay, so when we talk about the Medicaid expansion being an assistance at this point, then this is fulfilling, even though, it's still my understanding that the federal government is 100% responsible for the care of IHS patients, but this is an addition, or this is that third-party reimbursement, so it's another aspect of federal government paying for these services. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I think that the reason that the federal government reimburses states at 100% federal match is for IHS beneficiaries who are also Medicaid beneficiaries who receive their care through an IHS facility, through the tribal claiming policy, the federal government reimburses states at 100% in recognition of the federal trust responsibility to tribes and their tribal members.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sullivan Leonard, I think, wanted to follow up on an earlier question, and then Representative Tarr is in the queue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to know if you can answer my question from earlier.
Do you want a reminder what the question was?
Oh, certainly. Right, I should have written it down. Relatively, it was with regard to your discussion on how, as Medicaid moves forward in the state of Alaska, the state of Alaska will be increasing their percentage of what the state will pay versus what the federal government will pay for Medicaid costs. I was looking at that, and then also with regard to Senate Bill 74 from last year, there was discussion that we would be looking at savings through the Medicaid expansion of about $400 million, and I was trying to just see how we could accomplish that.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, thank you for the clarification. Our Medicaid program trends since 2015, we have reduced the amount of general fund that we spend on Medicaid, and we have increased our federal participation significantly. A part of that, quite frankly, is because of Medicaid expansion, and then the other part of that is through refinancing efforts through the new tribal claiming policy that I mentioned before. With Senate Bill 74, over a 10-year time period, which is, I think, the total or was it six? I'm sorry, 6-year time period, which is the dollar amount that you were referencing. Those are the savings that we anticipated because of the implementation of the reform opportunities to save the Medicaid program. So we're actually looking at reducing the amount of general fund and increasing the federal match with those reform opportunities. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The money part is interesting, but I also am interested in improved health outcomes. And so I'm just wondering, you know, certainly in the behavioral health category, for example, I mean, my understanding was Medicaid expansion was going to be able to provide behavioral health services to many individuals that wouldn't have otherwise had access to those important mental health or behavioral health services. Are we sort of doing any tracking over those outcomes, or maybe it's anecdotal, but, you know, I guess I don't want us to only entirely ever think about money because the whole purpose of spending it is to have better health and healthier communities, right? And I know you're very committed to that.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, Poyana for resetting me. So we have seen really people in Alaska who unfortunately haven't had access to healthcare before. What Mr. Chard was mentioning earlier, that a lot of the behavioral health providers provide really incredible services, but they provide what services they can with the resources that they have or they don't have. I'm going to step into the money zone for a minute, but I'm going to bring it back. Since September 1st of 2015, $30 million in behavioral health services have been provided to expansion population, to the folks in Alaska who are enrolled in Medicaid expansion. And unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I'm not sure, when folks are, you know, the providers are, you know, for the most part, they're nonprofit organizations, and they are really grassroots organizations who are providing services to the best of their ability. But they also have to operate like a business, and there is a limitation on the amount of charity care that they can provide and still keep the lights on and still pay for their expenses. And so those additional Medicaid expansion resources, those dollars that came in, again, primarily federal dollars, have really increased their ability to be able to provide services, to be able to keep their doors open, not for the sake of keeping their doors open, but to continue to provide services to Alaskans who we know that we need access to care.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was important to get on the record. Did you have something else you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, yes. And, you know, it is anecdotal, but we hear routinely from folks, and just in the interest of protecting their privacy, I'm not going to share a lot of details about them because of we are We are bound by HIPAA rules. You know, we've received so many letters. The governor, I, a whole bunch of folks have received letters, just incredibly, I mean, letters that just make you cry, from people who whose lives have been saved. Without Medicaid expansion, they would not have been able to get the surgery that they needed to be able to have their cancer treated. We've received letters from folks who've said, you know, I was in a position where I was too sick to work, and I'm now able to get, and now back on my feet, and I just started a job again for the first time in years. And so we're really excited about the opportunity that, you know, people can't work, they can't hunt, and they can't fish if they're not well enough to do so. And any economic development opportunity that we consider in our state, whether it's building a gas line, whether it's oil development, whether it's fishing, whether it's whatever, pick any industry, we have to have Alaskans who are well enough to be able to do that work. And for the first time, 32,000 Alaskans have access to health care that they simply didn't have before.
I also want to thank you, Representative Carr, for helping with the reset there. I think that one of the things that we forget is that for many people, healthcare is what stands between them and independence and self-sufficiency and living a vibrant quality life. And when it gets down to it, we care a lot about dollars and cents, but the reason that we do this is so that people can realize their full potential. Sometimes I think being on this side of the microphone puts us at a bit of a disadvantage. I know in my work at the Salvation Army, I was in touch with people all of the time who had, you know, who had been, you know, disadvantaged because they couldn't get health care and couldn't work, or, you know, were homeless and unable to care for their children because of inability to get health care, and then being able to get some support helped get them over the line. And so I want to thank you as well, Commissioner Davidson, for sharing some stories with us, because I think it's important for us to keep in mind what it's really all about. So I want to thank you, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one follow-up. When we were working through the Medicaid expansion effort, you know, on the legislative side of things, one of the things that I recall being said was that there would be a pent-up demand because of these individuals who hadn't had access to health care, and once they did have access, then, you know, I could think of, for example, if you haven't been to a dentist in a number of years, I bet when you went in, it could be several thousand dollars because you probably have cavities, need x-rays, and potentially surgery, and on and on. You know, so I guess the way I understood that was the expectation would be that early on you might see some increase in costs as, you know, people finally had access, and then because of that lack of access for however long had been in that individual's life, you know, and the need to sort of catch up on all their health care needs. Is there any way we are able to follow that trend, or do you sort of see that kind of thing? And so, for example, you know, once people have kind of gotten, you know, if it's someone who might have been going to become diabetic, for example, and now we've been able to prevent that, are we able to sort of track any of that?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, you're correct. That has been the experience of states, and that has also been Alaska's experience as well. A couple of things. One, a part of it is we have more people who are eligible for Medicaid expansion than we anticipated. We also have people who are more Alaskans who are eligible for regular Medicaid, simply because our economy, unfortunately, continues to tank. We are not at the bottom of our recession, according to all of the economists, and unfortunately, when people lose their jobs or lose their income, people are eligible for these services. In terms of the spend, inpatient hospital was a significant part of the spending. And what this tells us is, you know, there were, and what we know from the data is that there were really a lot of life-saving operations. And so people had been putting off their health care simply because they just couldn't afford to go. And other is in terms of pharmaceuticals, we have a lot of folks who have medical conditions, again, because they were putting things off as long as they could. Our pharmaceutical expenditures were also higher than we anticipated. And you know, these were a lot of them were for things like high blood pressure and diabetes. And so the other thing that we saw, as I mentioned earlier, is that we saw a high utilization for a little bit for travel because people were accessing specialists. If you live in a small community that doesn't have a cardiologist or a pulmonologist or any of the ologists, that then you and it's medically necessary for you to travel and you have that pre-authorization, then Medicaid also covers that travel as well.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Davidson and Deputy Commissioner. We're going to go ahead and put this resolution aside for further consideration by the committee. You have a question on your face.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Did you want me to talk about the Affordable Care Act at all and where we are, or maybe another time?
Maybe another time at this point. We're starting to get a little bit tight on time. Thank you.
Quiana.
All right, so we're going to now continue on to House Bill 234, which is extending the Alaska Healthcare Commission.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Witten, you're going solo this afternoon?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Bold of you. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Can you go ahead, put yourself on the record, and then recap the bill for the committee today?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, for having me today. My name is Seth Witten. I am staff for Representative Guttenberg. He's very sorry he couldn't join us today. He's up in House Finance, and they're doing what they do up there, so wish them luck. Today we're here before you. I'm here before you with HB 234. This is a bill that would extend the Alaska Healthcare Commission. Since 2010, the Healthcare Commission has been the only permanent body that has analyzed policy and provided overall recommendations for how to develop a more productive, more sustainable healthcare system in the state of Alaska. Obviously, that's a pretty big mission. There, as we discussed in the last committee hearing, have been some questions about the efficacy of the commission, what they're doing. It is our office's belief that it is incredibly important in the tumultuous landscape that is healthcare. We saw today, and you know, we called on our friends in D.C. and asked them if they could do something to kind of remind us that, hey, healthcare is changing. It's changing all the time. And thanks to the United States House of Representatives for taking a vote this morning to remind us that, you know, healthcare is changing. And it is an incredibly complex issue across the country and certainly maybe even more so in Alaska. So our bill is a pretty simple one-page kind of thing that would extend the Healthcare Commission and give us an opportunity to continue to look at it, continue to retool it. If we need to look at membership, if we need to look at purpose and mission, those are certainly things we would like to discuss. But we do feel like it's an important tool for the state of Alaska.
Are there any questions for Mr. Witten today? Representative Johnston.
Yes, I noticed that you have a zero fiscal note.
Yes.
And it seemed like you or Representative had both mentioned that one of the reasons of extending this is so that we don't lose the work that's been done. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes, ma'am.
Are all of the reports that have currently been done, are they online, digitally?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct. You can go back to, I believe, 2009 is the first report in the bill packet. I provided the report from 13 and then 14. But yes, you can go back and find all the reports over the lifetime of the commission.
So it is available, if no matter what we do, that the work that has been done is still available online. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. Yes, those reports will be available. I would defer, I think, Deb Erickson may be on the line, and whether or not the commission's website will be maintained after the end of the fiscal year, I do not know the answer to that.
Okay. And follow up, and I keep, of course, always I keep, the healthcare authority and then the Health Care Commission. And the Health Care Authority has mainly been in response to Medicaid reform. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'm certainly not an expert on that. What I can tell you about the Healthcare Authority is that per SB 74, passed last year, we're currently undergoing a feasibility study, and that study is due for completion at the end of the fiscal year. The folks that I've spoken to at the department have said that they're on track to have that done. They had hoped to release some information from phase one of that study a little sooner, but haven't been able to do that. Again, the SB 74 did not mandate the creation of the healthcare authority. It requested a feasibility study. So contingent on that study, the legislature then will then determine what to do with respect to the authorities.
I'll actually step in and answer that question. The healthcare authority is actually not the purview of the Department of Health and Social Services. It's the purview of the Department of Administration, and it relates to the department's role as an employer. And so we're looking at the possibility of consolidating the various healthcare plans and healthcare coverage that is paid for by the state of Alaska. And so it's a separate entity and not related to the healthcare commission at all.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that because as you can tell, I've been struggling with this.
Well, it will be a very interesting plan, and it's due a report, and it's due out this summer. It is not related to the Healthcare Commission, which was largely related to the quality of and the kinds of care that's delivered, and less about how it's paid for. And we believe Representative Kito had a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Whitten. So, in review of the background material, there's an audit that actually recommends, and we considered that audit, I think, over the summer in the LBNA committee, that recommends sunset of the commission. Can you explain the benefits of keeping the commission open? Even though there's no fiscal note, there will be an expense for the legislature as the commission comes up to sunset again and another audit is going to be required. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Representative Kito, that's an excellent question. And essentially, the commission has been unfunded since 2015. So as of 2015, it has been inactive. The LBNA audit did look at the commission to determine whether they were meeting their legislative intent. And there was a strong feeling from LBNA that the commission needed to do more. And they told them their sunset audit, the previous sunset audit, that they had done fine in terms of identifying some of the issues, determining some recommendations, creating some data sets that had been very useful, but that they needed to move towards implementation. The department and the commission, and you can look back through transcripts from the meetings, but there were some differences of opinions in terms of how much it was the commission's job to implement a healthcare plan. In the statute, it reads that the commission is to provide recommendations for and foster the development of a statewide plan to address quality, accessibility, and availability of healthcare for all citizens of the state. So in that somewhat ambiguous language, it doesn't say directly to the commission, your job is to implement this plan. Things didn't happen exactly as LBNA would have liked to see them happen in order to give them a glowing audit and in order to recommend an extension.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Whitten, I seem to recall in reading the audit that it was development of a plan, not implementation of a plan, that they were tasked in statute with developing a healthcare plan, and that to date a plan had not been developed, so that they had not been meeting their legislative intent, and that's another reason that they were suggested for sunset.
Through the chair, Representative Kito, my understanding, and if you look at the statute, the plan is mentioned explicitly. It's chapter 18 of the statute books, and they are responsible for providing recommendations for and fostering the development of the statewide plan is what the statute tasked the commission with. As I looked back through the transcripts of meetings, prior to defunding, they had had conversations with LBNA where they were told you need to move more from these recommendations and into implementation. And when Chris Curtis testified from LBNA at the previous hearing, my understanding of Ms. Curtis's testimony was that the feeling was that they weren't doing enough to implement the plan, that feedback had been provided to the commission, and that while there was some momentum building at that point, the point at which they were defunded in 2015 kind of, you know, put all that on the back burner.
All right. We do have Chris Curtis in the room. Would you like to, would we like to sort of clarify? So I know there's another question in the queue that's lining up, but I would
get to that point. That would be nice.
Yeah. All right. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, could we please have Chris Curtis come forward?
Excellent.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm the state's auditor. And if you excuse my facial expressions, I'm dealing with some vertigo, so the light's kind of... But in response to the question, the recommendations, what I discussed last time was that our recommendation and our findings had to deal with the lack of an actionable plan. And that our belief is that although they did have a framework created, that framework lacked the actionable components to effectively impact healthcare in Alaska because it didn't go far enough to explain how these 50,000-foot level recommendations and framework were going to actually be implemented. So that probably is the confusion about the word implementation, is that the plan, the framework they created, in our opinion, was not a plan, did not meet the purpose of the statute.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Ms. Curtis, first a statement and then a question. I've watched the Healthcare Commission from its inception to present, and I was working in the governor's office at the time that it was initiated through the administrative order process. And through the years, much like what your audit had identified, there was never a clear plan that was developed as the administrative order had requested. And I find that problematic. I don't discount the work that has been done on this commission. I think the work is something we could probably use in the future. But my concern is that if this particular extension of the Alaska Healthcare Commission moves forward, I believe we're just going to continue to do the same thing that we've been doing for the last 6-7 years. Ms. Curtis, would it be beneficial then to consider a new piece of legislation that could clearly identify what it is that a healthcare commission may look at and then move forward with some clear direction, as opposed to using an administrative order from 2008 that has, I believe, caused some difficulty with this commission?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair. One thing we found as far as the cause of not moving forward was the ambiguous statutory language. So if there was more clarity as far as expectation on behalf of the legislature, I think that would be helpful to make sure all parties know what the expectation is moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Proceed.
And a statement, actually. Maybe it's something then that our committee could look at, Madam Chair, with regard to a possible piece of new legislation to bring forward as a committee piece, not to discount Representative Gutenberg's work. Mm-hmm. But again, my concern is that if we move forward, we're going to just follow the same path that we did previously. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, actually, this is a timely segue to a discussion that represented the bill sponsor and I had actually earlier today. It's sort of, you know, my observation that that the
that the mandate of the Healthcare Commission, as it was originally administrative order and then later in statute, was not always implementable, and that there was some tension in the way that it was implemented. And if you have two bosses and the two bosses tell you two different things, you're almost always going to end up with a subpar product in the end. Everybody needs to be aligned and going the same direction. And the bill sponsor would very much like to see the Healthcare Commission, stay on the books and move forward. And we have agreed to work over the interim on a potential revision or a committee substitute for the bill, which could narrow its scope a little bit and ensure that it's serviceable in today's healthcare environment. As Mr. Witten referenced several times earlier, healthcare is evolving all of the time, it's changing all of the time. We know that there was an ACHA bill that was passed in the House at the federal level, which, would represent a major change. And so, using an administrative order and then a statute that was created 8+ years ago is probably not practical today in 2017. And so, with that, it's actually my intention to set this bill aside and to work with the bill sponsor over the interim. Any questions or comments? No. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just trying to think about how this would work, because it will expire on June 30th of 2017. So I guess over the interim, it would be sort of maybe a rework, but it would essentially go away in between, or how does that work?
So Ms. Curtis is dying to respond, so I'll let her do that.
Good word. Through the chair, although it does sunset, the board has a one-year wind-down administrative period. Mm-hmm. So what happens when a board is not extended, they have that one-year period, and so through the years, there have been occasions where for some reason or another, a bill doesn't move forward and the board is subject to sunset, and then the bill comes back the next year, as long as it's within that one year wind down period.
All right, great. And that would mitigate the need for the sunset audit at this point in time?
Through the chair,
a new sunset audit?
Yes, right. Through the chair. There would not need to be a new sunset audit if a bill was passed within the next, before July 1st, 2018.
Okay, great. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair, Chris Curtis, Ms. Curtis. If we do sunset, it sounds like there was not any activity taking place already. So what activities would they be responsible for during the sunset period? And then I do have a follow-up. So for the next year, if they haven't been active now, will staff have identified duties that they have to perform until we get to next year?
Through the chair, as far as I'm understanding, there is no staff and there is no committee. It's just my understanding is there is an intent to want to keep the law on the books, so when there possibly isn't a need or funding available to be able to start them up again, but there is going to be some time period to reappoint members. My understanding is that the members have now all expired, their terms have expired per the last discussion.
Yes.
So there is no staff, there's no funding, there would be, I don't believe that this intent is to actually make them active right away without funding.
Okay, and for the other follow-up, thank you through the chair, Ms. Curtis, if we do go into sunset or if we do allow it to sunset, my question is, does the law stay on the books with the sunset of the 2017 date? That means it's still a law, just not in effect, and at some point in the future, then can we just come back in and reauthorize it? I guess I'm asking, does the statute go away, or does the statute just stay there and say this expired in 2017?
Through the chair, Representative Kito. It is my understanding it just stays, and my own statutes had some old 1980 review these programs with these old dates in them. They did not go away, but that's probably a question for LegLegal, but it's my understanding that it just sits there.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments on this? We will actually follow up on that, the particular question with regard to the statutes, whether or not they disappear or they stay on the books. My understanding, they stay on the books, but we'll just clarify and confirm that. If we learn anything different, we'll be sure to share that with the rest of the committee. Thank you, Ms. Curtis, and thank you, Mr. Witten, very much. All right. Now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 236 by Representative Kawasaki, which is extending the senior benefits payment program. Mercedes Colbert is here for Representative Kawasaki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of House HES Committee. My name is Mercedes Colbert, staff to Representative Kawasaki, who is also up in House Finance with Representative Guttenberg. So just to recap what HB 236 does, it's just a few lines that extends the senior benefits program to the year 2022. Without legislative action, this program would end in 2018. The senior benefits program protects low-income seniors by providing modest cash assistance based on the federal poverty line from 75% of the federal poverty level to 175% of the level. And so right now that is about $76 per month up to $250 per month depending on the income level of the recipients. Just under 12,000 Alaskans receive the benefit currently. That's essentially it really is what the program does. It's been in place since 2007 and it is a successor to the longevity bonus program that was established in 1972. So it's been a long-standing bipartisan supported program that supports our lowest income seniors in the state, and it simply just extends another 4 years.
All right. Are there any questions for all right. Representative Eason.
Through the chair. Can you just recap for the record, what is it that drives the amount that the benefit is currently at for the different levels?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's based on the federal poverty level from 75% up to 175% of the level. And we also have the director here that could speak maybe more specifically if you have more specific questions about it. But it's based on their income level, but also eligibility. Assets are not counted towards their income. The income limits change yearly among how the federal poverty level also changes. And eligible seniors cannot be in prison or jail. They cannot be in Alaska Pioneers Home or Veterans Home or a nursing home or a public or private institution for mental disease. So it's not every senior that may have a certain income level. It's also a few exclusions as well. But if that answers your question.
Follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to know, so what is the goal of how each of the calculations result? So obviously their eligibility is based on federal poverty level, and that varies. Now, the various amounts that are actually part of the benefit, what is the goal that we're trying to raise people up to, and that drives the exact amounts that are currently in the program?
Through the chair, I feel more comfortable if the Director Windham answered that question. She has a longer mm-hmm. history.
Can you come forward? Director Windham.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Monica Windham. I'm Director for the Division of Public Assistance. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the dollar amounts for senior benefits are set in statute. The reason for the exact dollar amounts, I couldn't speak to.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
And how old are the statutes that we're talking about? How long has it been since those figures were recalculated?
2007.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnston is ahead of you. Sorry.
I would just, because I think we're about to say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just some historical background on this is there was, and Representative Keita, we could all be telling you this, there was the longevity bonus, and this was during one of our other times when revenues were running short, and it was Governor Murkowski's administration, And actually, I think Cheryl Frasca did a lot to come up with some of the numbers, but it was to make it needs-based as opposed to the longevity bonus was for any senior over 65. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, the percentage amount is set in statute, but that's an annual adjustment in terms of what the dollar amount is because it doesn't, it annually adjusts for inflation, I believe.
Through the chair, the dollar amounts for each benefit level don't increase with inflation. The income limits for each level increase every year with the federal poverty level.
That's what I was thinking. Thank you.
And is the dollar amount, is that set in statute then?
Mm-hmm.
So the specific amount that we allow is set by statute and not by budget?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, with one exception.
Mm-hmm.
We did, last year, our regulations were updated to allow us to, or maybe it was the year before, to adjust the benefit levels if the appropriation was not enough to meet the needs based on the caseload size.
Uh-huh.
And last year, the two bottom income tiers were fully funded. The top income tier was given a flat amount.
Mm-hmm.
So we projected a $76 benefit mm-hmm. for that top income amount
mm-hmm.
based on the appropriation and the number of recipients we had in the program at the time. That's why it was $76 for that amount instead mm-hmm. of $125. Which is what the normal amount is.
Representative Johnston.
And a follow-up, as far as the governor's budget this year, he has taken out that top tier, is that correct?
I don't recall.
I recall that anybody else? That. Okay.
I don't think so. Is it? All right. We're not certain. We're not certain. It sounds like we need an answer to that question.
All right.
Perhaps Ms. Colbert could get that an answer to that question.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Chair, well. Representative Eastman, did you have another question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, can you speak to projections that you have now? Obviously, we're in a recession. Most Alaskans' incomes aren't going up. Many are going down. What's the expectation of the next few years as to how that might impact this program?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we've estimated, based on history, that the caseloads will increase about 2% each year.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify and make sure that I understand, you said that they've been increasing, your caseloads have been increasing about 2% year per year?
Correct.
And what does that mean in terms of hard numbers, roughly?
In here somewhere.
Great. We'll just patiently wait. No rush.
So for FY17, mm-hmm. at the highest income level, we have about 4,800 recipients right now. And actually, that level is the only one that has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
A bit this year.
Mm-hmm.
The fiscal note doesn't have the numbers. I apologize. Here's some history on it. In FY14, that highest income level had 5,066, and then this year it's got 4,873. The $250 level in February 2014 had 5,066, and this year's got 1,646. That can't be right because it hasn't gone down that much.
Is it possible you could follow up with that information? Yeah, it'd be nice to know sort of what the trend is and what the baseline is, so we kind of understand the scope of the program, and it's not right here in the fiscal note. So that'd be really nice. Yeah, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. On the senior benefits program fact sheet that was provided to us, do you have that? Because I see on page 2 they do talk about the number of recipients that have increased from 2011 to 2015, and it does show the increase that you've indicated.
Ah, there we go.
Do you have that there, ma'am?
I do.
Okay.
I actually
wrote. Is that kind of answering the question? Okay.
There you go.
So that it shows an increase from 2011. We had 10,576 recipients total in the program, and this year we have 11,629, or 2016.
Oh, here we are. I was under the wrong bill in my folder, so that's part of the challenge. All right, thank you. Are there any other questions for Ms. Windham or for Ms. Colbert? All right. Seeing none, at this time I'm going to appoint a subcommittee to work on this legislation over the interim. And I'm appointing the following members of the HESS subcommittee, myself as chair, Representative Tarr and Representative Sullivan Leonard. Will work with the bill's sponsor and the department over the interim and be prepared to report back to the full committee when we reconvene again in January. A quick announcement prior to, thank you very much, I apologize. Thank you much very much for your testimony today and for bringing the bill forward. A quick announcement prior to adjourning this hearing today is that the meeting for this Saturday has been canceled. The time is 4:38, and this hearing of the House HESS Committee is now adjourned.